Because wood plastic composite starts as a paste, it can be molded to almost any shape and size, including arched or bent shapes. That innate flexibility extends to color as well, as it can be dyed or colored to fit almost any project design. Depending on if polyethylene or polypropylene the sawdust is mixed with, WPC can be used for a variety of construction projects in much the same way as natural lumber. Drilling, planing, sanding, it's all done just as easily with WPC. Some construction professionals believe that wood fasteners, like nails and screws, actually achieve a better hold in WPC as compared to normal wood, and WPC is likely to split or break when screws are used near the end of the planks, which can be a common problem when using real wood. The company we just mentioned represents only a part of a vibrant market in Iran, encompassing many other companies that take advantage of this environmentally friendly product. Together, they produce a wide range of building and decorative materials that have been used in private homes, hotels, offices, hospitals, commercial, and recreational settings. The array of manufactured products by the Iranian businesses include flooring and deck profiles, wall coverings, partitions, wall panels, rails and doors, and did we mention outdoor furniture? In fact, if you are planning to start a new construction project in the near future, then you should consider these new products that are surprising people all over the world. Most of the interest in many countries is concentrating on the durability and extended service life of WPC due to its large applications in outdoor use. Also, one of the greatest advantages of WPC products is their low maintenance cost as compared to that of solid wood. According to experts, WPC material has a production cost of about 15% more as compared to that of normal lumber, but requires a lower maintenance cost. The actual payback period is estimated at 3 to 5 years compared to pressure-treated decking material. What is most remarkable is the fact that used WPC can be recycled to create brand new WPC, making it the ultimate recyclable commodity. Wood plastic composites are capable of achieving a huge range of characteristics while always keeping one thing in common, which is sustainability. As consumer attitudes towards our responsibility to the planet are changing, smarter materials offer a way forward. Wood plastic composites, in fact, display an incredibly wide range of potential applications. By adjusting the species, size, and concentration of wood particles in the formulation, different outcomes can be achieved. Wood plastic composites can even be foamed to make a strong, lightweight material. Similarly, the chosen wood species will also have an impact on the final product's color. Pine fillers tend to produce products that are lighter in color compared to hardwood fillers. This available range in the look and feel of products made from wood plastic composites offers a wide range of designer preferences. So far, product applications have included children's toys, automotive interiors, patio furniture, garden edging, and more. Furthermore, R&D products using biopolymers or biodegradable polymers have also been launched. These may be competitive either in the market for green consumerism, where 100% bio-derived product is well accepted, or in the market for disposable plastic items, as the search for an easily biodegradable product and the development of a waste industry capable of handling it continues. Iran is associated with many things. If you are into geology, that would be oil oozing out of the land. Iran is among the world's top five in oil reserves. But oil or petroleum is not the only mineral resource that makes the country rich. Copper is among its other riches, as are lead and zinc. In case you didn't know, Iran has over 220 million tons of proven zinc and lead ore reserves. That is significant. But in copper, it has stood among the top 10. What is being done about all that treasure? It can't all stay underground forever. And there are those extracting and producing the minerals. To meet some of them, we made a trek to Zadin Industrial and Mining Group. In 2009, Iran produced 383,000 tons of copper, meaning it had the world's ninth largest reserves of copper at 32.5 million tons. As a matter of fact, the mines at Sarçeşme in Kerman province contain the world's second largest load of copper ore, that is 5% of the world's total in 2009. Iran is one of the most important mineral producers in the world, ranking among 15 major mineral-rich countries. It was estimated to hold some 68 types of minerals, 37 billion tons of proven reserves, and more than 57 billion tons of potential reserves worth $770 billion in 2014. That is not to say mining in Iran has no more work to be done on it. It is still under development, but there are plenty of doers in this country, and plenty more are waiting for further opportunity to arise for their turn at investment. Zadin Group has already arrived at a point to claim we have done what we could. Flotation, or in other words, ore dressing in mineral processing, is a main process of reduction. It is a method used to separate and concentrate ores by altering their surfaces to a hydrophobic or hydrophilic condition. These chemical and physical changes to the surface of minerals are made using materials with different properties, including activators. Now, in working with minerals, the production process is most efficiently carried out in stages. And what a company just cannot do without is its laboratory for pilot tests before going head in with its whole stock. It is literally to avoid the proverbial haste that makes waste. An asset to corporations is their R&D departments. The reason is they perform research for technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones, hence elevating the company's industrial standing. The corporation's labor paid off. Zadin has registered or patented 26 inventions, five of which are already industrialized and are being used in the production line. Indeed, standard is everything, especially for foreign trade. And Iran's production by far outweighing its domestic use, there is plenty of room for mineral exports from this country. The industry is export-oriented, as a matter of fact. Only 80 to 100,000 tons of produced zinc ingots and 50 to 80,000 tons of lead ingots are consumed domestically. And the remaining were exported to target markets in Asia and Europe, going by 2014 and 2015 estimates. The National Iranian Copper Industries Company is one of the largest companies listed on the Tehran Stock Exchange. It was the largest non-oil exporter in Iran in 2010, with exports worth $1.3 billion. Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, the oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil. This time, we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique. Thank you. Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Soze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services. The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and off land. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more. Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services. One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality. Here's a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from the removal of sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed. As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas, and Iran makes a large amount of both. Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
The electric elevator industry in Iran is 80 years old. Initially, packaged elevators were imported into Iran, but currently, dozens of domestic manufacturers are producing different models of elevators and lifts, as well as their equipment. Some of them have managed to export their products to other countries, and today we are visiting one of them. Now, the sector is thriving. Iran has the capacity to produce 80,000 lifts each year, but annual productions are at 25,000 units due to stagnation in the construction industry. The total number of operating elevators in Iran is at nearly 750,000, from which 250 million people use on a daily basis.
We are almost out of time for this program, but before we go, let's briefly check out some news and trends about Iran's non-oil exports.
According to the head of Iran Customs Administration, Alireza Muqaddasi, Iran exported 122 million tons of commodities worth $48 billion in the previous year. While the value of annual exports has risen by 41% compared to the previous year, Iran imported more than 40 million tons of goods worth $52 billion, including basic commodities, raw materials, and machinery. The top five exporters to Iran were the UAE, China, Turkey, Germany, and Russia, while the main destinations of Iran's exports included China, Iraq, Turkey, the UAE, and Afghanistan. According to Vice President for Science and Technology, Surenas Attari, in recent years, different steps have been taken with this regard, such as launching houses of innovation in Kenya, China, Russia, Syria, and Turkey so far. The centers are mainly formed with the investment and support of the private sector to provide the necessary infrastructure for the exports. Knowledge-based companies gained about $800 million in revenue from exports in the Iranian calendar year ended in March 2021, and the figure was expected to reach up to $2 billion in the following year. Africa, neighboring countries, Southeast Asia, and Eurasia are the other target priorities.
That covers our program on wood plastic composite sector in Iran. Don't forget to give us your feedback. Also, you can email us with your thoughts and topic suggestions. You never know, we may just make a program on your suggestions. I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
In the limelight.
Contrary to the bank's claim of climate leadership, its pledge to reduce emissions intensity is fully compatible with a massive expansion of fossil fuels, said one campaigner. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Bank of America accused of using accounting tricks as real climate action. Here's the story. Climate action groups denounced Bank of America for displaying one of the worst examples of corporate greenwashing as the bank released its climate targets for 2030, centering their plan of action on reducing carbon emissions intensity instead of reducing their absolute emissions. With CEO Brian Moynihan claiming the bank aims to help ensure a just, stable transition to the sustainable future we all want, the bank announced that it would reduce the intensity of its emissions instead of absolute emissions. Emissions intensity refers to the volume of emissions measured against another unit, while a pledge to reduce absolute emissions would require Bank of America to reduce the amount of emissions it is sending into the atmosphere over time. By using carbon intensity metrics, Bank of America has set up a situation where its overall greenhouse gas emissions could continue to rise until 2030, and it would still be able to claim that it has met its climate goals, said Alec Cannon, co-director of the Stop the Money Pipeline Coalition. The bank announced its pledge less than 2 weeks after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released its latest report on the climate crisis, reiterating earlier warnings that the continued extraction of fossil fuels, for which Bank of America has provided at least $232 billion in financing since 2016, will put the Paris Climate Agreement's goal of limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius out of reach. In today's announcement, Bank of America touts its history of climate leadership and then unveils 2030 emissions targets, which are intensity only, fully compatible with increases in absolute emissions and massive expansion of fossil fuels, especially expanded extraction of fossil gas, said Jason Opinia Disterhoft, senior climate and energy campaigner for Rainforest Action Network. He added, Bank of America's intensity-only targets, which lag well behind U.S. and global best practice, put it firmly on the side of climate delay when time is quickly running out to cut absolute emissions in half by 2030. Bank of America will face a vote at its shareholder meeting on April 26th, with some of its investors calling on the bank to commit to policies ensuring its lending and underwriting do not support fossil fuel projects. Conan expressed hope that the bank's investors will take note of this duplicity and vote in favor of critical climate resolutions. Like too many of its peers, Bank of America is trying to pass off vague pledges and accounting tricks as real climate action, said Sierra Club Fossil Fuel Finance campaign manager Ben Cushing, adding, "The science is clear that achieving net zero financed emissions by 2050 means stopping funding for the expansion of fossil fuels," he added. "Reducing emissions intensity while increasing financing for the fossil fuel industry and overall financed emissions is utterly insufficient to achieve that target and contribute to a climate-stable future."
Sweden, a major arms exporter.
I call upon you, Desmond Tutu, to come to the rostrum and receive the Nobel Peace Prize for 1984 with a gold medal and a diploma.
It was less than 2 years after the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Desmond Tutu, a hero of the South African anti-apartheid movement, when one of the movement's supporters was shot dead on a cold winter night. The Kingdom of Sweden is the fourth European country that prides itself for its beautiful nature, snowy winters, and reindeers. But this lost paradise has another face. Sweden is the birthplace of the inventor of dynamite. Alfred Nobel was a Swedish chemist and gunsmith. After several experiments, Nobel discovered that if nitroglycerin was absorbed by a neutral substance, such as diatomaceous earth or diatomite, it would be safer and easier to handle than pure gunpowder or nitroglycerin. He called it dynamite. The new world needed explosions for development, and this brought about enormous wealth for Nobel. Dynamite soon became popular, and due to high demand, dynamite factories were set up one after another in different parts of the world. Although Nobel made a fortune by making and selling dynamite and other explosives he had invented, this pioneering in the business of explosion and death did not bring him good fame. One day, while having breakfast during his trip to Paris, cold sweat ran down Alfred's body when he saw a headline in a newspaper that read, "The Death of the Death Merchant." But the French newspaper was wrong. They had mistaken Alfred's brother Ludwig for him. However, in this mistake lay the reality of hatred for the inventor of dynamite. Thus, Nobel did not want to go down in history as the merchant of death. Alfred became obsessed with this issue. Until November 27, 1895, when at the Norwegian-Swedish Club, he unveiled his solution to get rid of public hatred. Nobel had made his mind. In his last will and testament, he devoted a large portion of his fortune to an award that was to be given to prominent figures in science, literature, and world peace, regardless of their nationality. It was called the Nobel Prize. Swedish people and politicians have always tried to preserve Nobel's peaceful legacy after his death, especially in the turbulent 20th century. They maintained their neutrality in both the First and Second World Wars. And even remained neutral during the Cold War. But there was violence and terror under the skin of this peaceful facade. No one would have thought that in 1986, Olof Palme, the then Swedish Prime Minister, would fall victim to the violence that Alfred Nobel tried to prevent by universalizing his Peace Prize. The assassination of Sweden's Prime Minister was difficult for the people of this country and shocking for the people of the world. Sweden, a peaceful country, had faced a new challenge: terror and violence. On September 11, 2003, Anna Lindh, Sweden's then foreign minister and social democratic politician, was stabbed to death by an assailant while shopping in downtown Stockholm along with a close friend. She died in hospital a few hours later. No one would have thought this would unleash a domino effect of violence and terror in Sweden. The resemblance of this murder to that of Olof Palme was controversial. Many had come to believe that the door to violence had been opened in Sweden. This level of atrocity was a shadow of the violence that Swedish weapons had inflicted outside the country. It seemed like the spilt blood had returned to exact revenge. It may seem hard to believe, but Sweden is among the world's top arms exporters. In 2017 alone, Sweden earned 3.5 billion euros from arms sales. Though it tries to show itself as a pacifist country, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Sweden is in fact a major arms exporter. It's as if this country is pretending to be what it's not. They sell weapons to countries that kill innocent people.
One, they say you have to be my wife by force, like they do raping and all this time. But I talk to them.
Despite Sweden's claim to pacifism, the country's wealthy companies, such as Lundin Energy, play an effective role in organized genocide in developing countries for their own economic gain.
I was 17 when the war broke out in my place I was. So I saw a horrible situation when we got a news that the village is going to be attacked by a militia.
They made a deal with militants to secure an oil-rich region. In return, the militants set fire to people's houses, raped and killed women, and forced people to become displaced.
I saw my people dying, children and women.
Meanwhile, Borg Ekholm, the CEO of the Swedish company Ericsson, recently admitted that the telecommunications giant had given money to ISIS as a bribe and that all the money had been spent on terrorist activities in Iraq.
Hate crimes in Sweden have seen a record rise, with cases jumping 14%.
The violence that quietly permeated the land of reindeers now wanted to make its presence public. Statistics show violence is on the rise in Sweden at an alarming rate. Research suggests that Swedish society is being affected by a social epidemic of violence and that armed crime is spreading like a contagious disease. As a result, in addition to social initiatives, the police of this country have resorted to a series of repressive measures to de-escalate the situation. Dozens of graves in a cemetery south of Stockholm belong to the victims of armed conflict. Half of the mothers sitting in this picture in front of the Swedish Interior Minister lost their children to violence. A young immigrant asks Sweden's Social Democratic Interior Minister, Michael Damber, "Have you ever seen so many mothers whose children have been killed?" Organized kidnapping is also on the Swedish government's agenda. The government of Sweden denies claims that Swedish social service agencies kidnap Muslim children. This is while many immigrant families have held campaigns under the title of "Stop Kidnapping Our Children." These families say Sweden's social security agency takes away their children from them because it claims the children's parents are unsuitable. Many Muslim families in Sweden have filed complaints against this agency. The families call this act of forced child-parent separation some sort of legal kidnapping. It is not without reason that Bild, the most widely circulated media outlet in Germany and the European Union, cites a wave of armed killings in Sweden in an article entitled "Sweden is the most dangerous country in Europe." It places the country at the top of Europe's gang crime list. In 2020, 124 deadly violence cases were confirmed in Sweden. The average lethal violence in the last 10 years was 100 cases per year. This growing trend of crime in a European country claiming to be peaceful is not normal. The Swedish government's inability to manage the situation is such that half of Swedes have lost faith in their country's criminal justice system. This is according to a survey by the Office for Crime Prevention, which is affiliated with the Swedish Ministry of Justice. Despite this, for politicians, it's business as usual. They hold the Nobel Peace Prize event every year with confidence. Former Myanmar Prime Minister Aung San Suu Kyi, who not only did not condemn the organized genocide of Rohingya Muslims in her country, but rather defended such crimes in the International Court of Justice.
Mr. President, the court has been asked to apply the 1948 Genocide Convention, one of the most fundamental...
Barack Obama, who Trump calls the founder of ISIS in the Middle East.
They created ISIS. Hillary Clinton created ISIS with Obama.
Shimon Peres, the prime minister of a regime that constantly commits war crimes against the Palestinians.
And last but not least, Menachem Begin, the former Israeli Prime Minister, who in an interview with the New York Times reporter, Ariana Falachi, officially introduced himself as a former terrorist. All of these mentioned names were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In line with its pacifist claims, Sweden passed laws that allowed it to deal with international crimes, such as war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, regardless of where they were committed. These laws gave the Swedish government vast powers to prosecute people from all over the world. However, in 2002, when peace activists filed a complaint with the Swedish police against then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for crimes against humanity, they soon realized that the prosecutor had stopped his investigation.
Some say 900 Palestinians died, some more than 2,000. No one knows.
The prosecutor's office refused to send a judicial team to Israel, claiming the probe was impossible. Perhaps the prosecutor was afraid that Zionist groups would do the same to the fact-finding committee as they did to Forky Bernadotte. Forky Bernadotte was a Swedish diplomat. He went to Israel to investigate the Arab-Jewish conflict, but was assassinated by Israeli extremist groups.
I think I have the right to believe that we sooner or later...
It seems Sweden's claim to peace sometimes fails in the interest of Swedish politicians, despite the high costs they incur for Swedish taxpayers. The Swedish prosecutor's office failed in the case of Ariel Sharon. Instead, Swedish police, in a joint operation with the CIA, arrested Julian Assange on charges of moral misconduct. Julian Assange was the one who published the documents of the US killing of civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq by launching the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. Earlier, Swedish authorities arbitrarily detained two Egyptian nationals, Mohammed al-Zairi and Ahmed Ajiza. They handed over these two men to US intelligence agents at Stockholm's Bromma Airport. CIA agents were waiting for them in a CIA Gulfstream jet numbered N379P. It's absolutely clear that Sweden has practically become a cog in the conspiracy and intelligence machine of the CIA against independent countries. In this regard, UN committees accused Sweden of violating human rights treaties and the Convention Against Torture. This Swedish setup does not end here. Some members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization and anti-Iran opposition abroad, through colluding with the Swedish prosecutor's office, have been able to play out a pre-designed and imaginary scenario. The members of the MKO, who easily hold a rally in front of the courthouse with the support of the Swedish police, are considered by the Iranian people as a terrorist and dangerous cult. They started a street war in Iran 4 decades ago. Masoud Rajavi and the leaders of this terrorist cult resorted to torture and organized assassinations when they failed in their riotous scheme. The MKO even went as far as assassinating the president, the prime minister, the head of Iran's Supreme Court, and more than 70 members of the Iranian parliament. The assassination of a legitimate prime minister is not a strange thing to the Swedish people. The murderers of Olof Palme were never found, and the case was closed. This is while those who assassinated the president and prime minister of Iran have openly confessed to their crimes, yet live freely in Sweden. In addition to the widespread assassinations of government officials, the MKO terrorists also commit child murder, carry out blind street assassinations, bury their opponents alive, engage in organized torture of ordinary people, and ultimately kill 17,000 innocent Iranians. They were close friends of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein set up Camp Ashraf for the group in Iraq so that members of the cult would continue their terrorist activities from there. The MKO stopped short of no crimes, and they helped Saddam in his massacre of the people of the city of Basra and the Kurdish people of Iraq. Interestingly, this terrorist cult, which has the blood of the Iraqi and Iranian people on its hands, currently continues its terrorist activities in Albania with the support of Saudi Arabia, the United States, and some European countries. Despite its legal capacity in the European Union, Sweden is now a tool in the hands of a well-known terrorist group, a group that even the Swedish prosecutor acknowledged to be a terrorist entity in his initial speech at the court. Nevertheless, the trial continues on the basis of a fictional show and mass collusion, and the Swedish court has become the venue for a pre-designed scenario. The question is, for the sake of what organization is the Swedish prosecutor squandering such a huge sum of money at the expense of the Swedish taxpayer? If you think the MKO is the only terrorist group present in Sweden, think again. This man, Habib Asivad, an official employee of the Swedish government, is another terrorist. He is currently on trial in Iran after being arrested for assassinating Iranian people, but his colleagues still live in Sweden. Under the name of Al-Nidhal Al-Ahwaziyya movement, they are still plotting terrorist acts against the Iranian people. The story of terrorist groups based in Sweden is not limited to the MKO and Al-Nidhal Al-Ahwaziyya. There are other dangerous groups in this country too. ISIS has been defeated in the Middle East, but its Swedish members are back home.
Welcome back to the program. Swedish police have set up a special task force to combat gangs following a wave of violence in...
The people of Sweden and some of the country's political parties have now realized that the policy of harboring murderers and violent groups has not only not brought credibility for Sweden, but also it has come at a heavy cost, including the atmosphere of terror and murder in Swedish society. Many are asking this question today. Isn't it time the rulers of Sweden admitted the failure of this policy? A member of the Swedish Parliament, who was previously one of the children left behind as a result of the ideological divorces at Camp Ashraf, criticized the former Swedish Prime Minister for meeting with the leader of the MKO. He asked the former Prime Minister, "How much did you get paid to lend yourself as an extra to a terrorist group?" Once known as the land of peace, Sweden has today become a hotbed of a host of terrorist and criminal groups. Not a week goes by that the media doesn't report a shooting incident. The question is, what would Alfred Nobel think of Sweden's name and symbol if he were here today? Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ramadan is the month of penitence. Among the characteristics that have been mentioned for the month of Ramadan, what particularly attracts my attention is the month of penitence. I'd like to discuss this point with you government officials. Penitence means going back when you realize that you are treading the wrong path, doing the wrong thing, and cherishing the wrong thought. It means turning back to Allah, the Exalted. This penitence has a meaning that is inherent to it. Going back means that we should find out where the problems lie and identify the path that is wrong. This is a very important point. As we move along, we often tend to turn a blind eye to the mistakes we make and to our faults. We fail to notice the problems that plague our work, that this happens in our individual responsibilities as well as our collective responsibilities involving our nation, our party, our movement, or our camp. We often ignore the problems with everything that is related to us. Therefore, other people should point out our flaws.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It appears that the month of Ramadan, among other months of the year, is like prayer time among other times of the day. That is to say, Holy Sharia has provided opportunities in the form of prayers for people who are restricted by material factors. The five daily prayer times are like an alarm. They provide us with a kind of privacy in order to illuminate our hearts and souls. Daily prayers have been made obligatory in order to prevent us from being submerged in the material world. They provide us with the opportunity to step out the material world, think about spirituality, and be submerged in the material world. It appears that the month of Ramadan has the same characteristic among other months of the year. It provides the human soul with an opportunity to break free. The month of Ramadan is an opportunity for our souls to be purified of material factors that surround us. It provides an opportunity for our souls to become illuminated. One of the great achievements of the month of Ramadan is repentance and returning to Allah the Exalted. In the Holy Dua of Abu Hamza Thumali, we read, "Let us gather around Mustafa and achieve the position of returning to you." We ask God to help us to achieve the position of repentance so that we can return to Him and return from deviant, bad, indecent actions, thoughts, and conducts. In the farewell dua of the auspicious month of Ramadan, Imam Sajjal alayhi salam says to the God of the world, "You are one who opened a door for your servants so that they return to you, so that they can return to you, and you name this door repentance." Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, dua number 45. He says to God that He opened this door for us so that we rush towards His forgiveness and benefit from the blessing of His forgiveness and mercy. This door is the door of repentance. It is a window to the pure view of divine forgiveness.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shabit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Dozens of people gathered in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to mark Palestinian Prisoners' Day, a day when resistance factions and their supporters stand in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
On this day, which marks the Day of Palestinian Prisoners, I am certain that the people of the Arab and Muslim worlds, as we see in this gathering, will show the true unity with the resistance and the path of the resistance, especially with the issue of the prisoners and Al-Quds, which are the emblem of the Palestinian struggle.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that one cannot be truly with Palestine if they are not with the resistance.
It has become clear that whoever is with Palestine should be with the resistance. Anyone who has declared that he is with Palestine but hasn't taken one practical step in supporting the resistance is not truly with Palestine. Military resistance comes first. The other forms of resistance back and help to serve the actual resistance with arms.
He recalled that after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, late Imam Khomeini took the decision to close the Israeli embassy and reinstate the